Cars, start your engines!
Hit the pace car! What for? Because you hit every other damn thing out there, I want you to be perfect!
When I'm driving, I got a guy on the radio who talks to me. You can see him. He talks to me.
He didn't slam you, he didn't bump you, he didn't nudge you, he rubbed you. And rubbin' son is racing.
Hey, race fans, welcome to the Hoobazoo Radio Network and welcome to Drafting the Circus. My name is Frank Santoroski. I'll be your host for the next hour as we go over everything racing. Before we get into our discussion, let me introduce you to the panel I have tonight. With me in the studio is Mr. Gray Warren from Richard Childress Racing, Richard Uden, race engineer, Seth Eggert, NASCAR correspondent at Motorsports Tribune, and Christopher DeHardy, IndyCar correspondent over there at Motorsports Tribune as well. How is everybody tonight?
Doing good.
Good, thank you.
All right, great to have you all on. So we're coming off of an off weekend for most of the major motorsports, Easter weekend, April Fool's Day. You know, there were some great April Fool's racing jokes and whatnot, but one of the bigger things that I was just thinking about, and I know, Seth, you were thinking about it as well, April 1st was the day that Alan Kubica passed away, 25 years ago. 25. It's hard to believe 25 years have come and gone because it feels like just yesterday. Kubica had won the Cup in 92, did it his own way. You know, is one of the sharper guys in there, had offers from the bigger teams, did it his own way, had a great battle. I still think that the 1992 Hooters 500 at Atlanta was the best NASCAR finale I've ever seen, you know, with no chase. And there's been some great other podcasts out there, specifically the Dinner with Racers that we had all listened to. You know, Alan and what he meant to the sport and what he could have done. Now, Seth, you wrote about it. You wrote about it a couple of years ago and reposted a story, but I know you're a big Kubica fan and just, you know, share some thoughts on, you know, what this means 25 years later.
Well, I'll admit Kubica was a little bit before my time, but the point is, like you said, I was a fan of his in the sense that I went back, I read about him, I watched old video of him racing, and he always insisted on doing things his way. He built his own engines, he built his own chassis, he insisted that he basically had perfection. And he won some poles, he had very fast cars. Sometimes they would last, sometimes they wouldn't. In 1992, it just happened that everything fell into place, that he won the championship almost on a tiebreaker, essentially, by leading the most laps. I want to say he won the championship by just 5 points, if I remember correctly. At the start of that season, he didn't even have sponsorship. It was about 5 or 6 races into the season that he got sponsorship from Hooters after they moved over to his team when their driver failed to qualify at Bristol. So it is the ultimate underdog, or as he called himself, the underbird story of NASCAR.
Yeah, absolutely. Now Gray, you were in the sport. Well, you've been in the sport, but you were there through the whole Kubica time and when he, you know, kind of came into the sport and is a little different than the rest and went his own way. So you've obviously, you know, your teams have raced against him and whatnot. So what are your some of thoughts of, you know, about Alan Kubica 25 years on?
Well, Allen came along in a time when a privateer could still make it in the sport. You had owner drivers at that time. Along in that era, Ricky Rudd comes to mind. Darrell Waltrip comes to mind also. And it was kind of at the end of an era when the sport was beginning to change, when it was transitioning a few years later to multi-car teams. And Allen came in and took advantage of it. He, like Seth alluded to, he wanted to do it his way. He had an engineering background, one of the first drivers to come into the sport with such a background. And he was a hands-on guy. He was hands-on in every aspect of the sport, from dealing with the sponsors, finding money, to working on the car, you know, all the mechanical aspects of the car. He was completely involved in it all. Great competitor, really good driver. When you talk about the 1992 title race, you go into that race with really actually three drivers right there that could win it. Had Davey Allison not got taken out in a wreck by Ernie Irvin, he more than likely would have come along and won the championship that year, because he was leading the points going into that race. After Davey retired from it, it left it up to Bill Elliott and Alan Kulwicki to decide it. And each lap that was led was very important. And Kulwicki gambled and stayed out, almost risking running out of fuel to garner the laps that he needed to win. And he had one more lap, I believe, than Bill Elliott did, and that allowed him to win the championship. And I agree with you, Frank. That was probably one of the most compelling championship races that I've ever seen as well.
Yeah, you know, it's so funny because, you know, with the chase, you've got four guys eligible for the championship. It's like, well, who's ever first of the four is going to win the thing. You didn't have the whole bouncing back and forth. Let's look at the points as they run and this and that. And that's a little bit of high drama that's gone from the sport. So, but you know, to some of your other guys' points. Yep. Yeah, go right ahead, Gray.
Well, that was the cumulative points race that year. And in fact, you go back to the September race at Dover, Allen wrecked and fell pretty far behind and was able to, over the stretch of races through the last half of September, October, and November, was able to capitalize on some of the bad luck of some of the other competitors and his good fortune, and was able to position himself to come into the season finale with a shot to win. So yeah, it was that's just the way it went down. It was a great season, and you know, he was ultimately crowned champion, and it really, you know, him being able to do that with a small underfunded team as you would compare him to RCR and some of the other teams back in those days. Penske, RCR, those teams. He really accomplished. Oh, and I forget, Junior Johnson as well was a powerhouse in that time too. So yeah, he was able to accomplish something that it was very rare, and probably we'll never see it again.
Yeah. Now, and things that Allen did still kind of exists to this day. And Seth, you've got a couple words on Allen's legacy and then what he left behind.
Well, some of his legacy is a mix of old and new. He was the first one to really celebrate after a victory, doing the Polish victory lap, or what he coined as the Polish victory lap, when he would turn the wrong way, wave to the fans, and as he said in his own words, give them something to remember him by. In 2015, the Kulwicki Driver Development Program was founded, and some of its alumni if I remember correctly, include Ty Majeski, who's running part-time in the Xfinity Series this year, Natalie Decker, who's running full-time in the ARCA Series this year, and I want to say there's one other who's running in the ARCA Series. The name slips me right now. He's also eligible for the Hall of Fame. Last year, he actually was tied for the last position, or basically entry, and after a revote, he was, I think, one percentage point behind. So, and in past years, whenever there's been a tie, that the driver who tied ended up, or person eligible for the Hall of Fame, has gone in the next year. And this is the NASCAR Hall of Fame. He's already in the International Motorsports Hall of Fame, the Motorsports Hall of Fame of America, and the he is also the alma mater that he went to, University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, created a center on campus named after him. Bristol has suites named after him, and Slinger's Super Speedway, his home track, holds the Alan Kwicki Memorial every year.
Yeah, I just think it's so sad. You know, his death was so sudden, and it was a freak accident. It was an aviation accident within NASCAR travel. I believe they were on the way to Bristol, if I'm not mistaken.
That is correct.
But when the plane went down, you know, and air travel is a part of what comes with the thing. But he was, you know, early 93, early in the season, defending his crown. You know, we don't know what he might have done in years to come. You know, had he survived that plane crash, or had that plane not gone down, he might have won another championship. He may still be a team owner. He might be one of the big team owners in this series right now, you know, competing with the Penske's and Hendricks of the world. But, you know, like they say, the world will never know. And, Chris, to your point, he was the first NASCAR champion with a college education. Had an engineering degree, which somewhat gave him a leg up on the prior, traditionally what you would known as a race car guy, who was somebody who learned how to work in a car in the garage with his dad or on the farm or whatnot. And he kind of broke the mold of what a NASCAR guy was. Now, Chris, and I know you followed Alan with great respect as well. So, Chris, I want to get some thoughts from you.
Yes, we said Alan did it his way. At the NASCAR banquet in 1992, the song that they played him off with was My Way by Frank Sinatra, and he actually said you have to use the Frank Sinatra version. So even when they played My Way, he did it his way. the crazy thing about Kulwicki with what he did was that when you look at him against the guys that he was racing against, he was racing with basically a third of the budget, almost, or less than half the budget of what the other guys were spending. And other guys maybe had like 100 full-time employees, and he had like 16. So you really had to multitask if you were going to work for him. But the thing with Kulwicki was that even though he was notoriously hard to work with for a lot of people, once he trusted you, he was practically your best friend. And another thing is that he is now eligible for the NASCAR Hall of Fame. He was listed as one of the nominees for the Hall, and fans can actually vote to have him included in the Hall of Fame on NASCARHall.com and NASCAR.com as well. And personally speaking, I plan on maybe, you know, doing a vote just for the heck of it, but if I can, I'd like to see Alan get in with Davey Allison, because those two are massively intertwined with how that 92 season ended up.
And how the 93 season was so tragic.
Yes, and there's a hashtag for it, AK4HOF. The O is lowercase.
You know, and I tell you, both very deserving, and the fact that he's a former champion will carry a lot of weight with the group that will decide who is enshrined this time. But, you know, Alan was a very driven individual, and like you alluded to, he was difficult to work with, and it was because he was a perfectionist. And I have no doubt that he would have parlayed that championship that he won in 1992 to greater things. I would imagine that if he were still alive today, he would probably be still be a car owner on the level of RCR and Penske and Joe Gibbs and the like. So I'm sure, you know, he was smart with his money. He was a good businessman. And I feel certain, you know, if we could, you know, look down the road, he would be one of the forces in our sport today.
Yeah, I just remember, you know, just going to the race at Martinsville later in the season, and somewhere along the line there, you know, Jeff Bodine had bought the assets of the Kowicki team. I believe it was just like weeks before the fall Martinsville race, Al Kowicki Racing was bought by Jeff Bodine, and the hauler was there in the infield in Martinsville. The Hooters logo was spray painted over. The big AK logo was spray painted over, and the spray paint wasn't even thick enough to hide that. And I just remember how sad I felt at that time. You know, Kowicki had just come off this wonderful 92 season, winning the championship, and then here's what's left of it now. And then now, you know, for his part, Bodine did well with the team for the next couple of years, but in this day and age, that whole team and what was the beginnings of it, the shop, it's all disappeared. It's all gone. And we just have those memories to cling to. So, but
well, the original shop is still there. It sits behind Charlotte Motor Speedway right off Moorhead Road. It's the current home of Levine Family Racing right now. So the shop and all is still there. But yeah, I recall the night it happened. We were getting ready to, some of us getting ready to go to Bristol in the next few days. And when it happened, the word quickly spread. It wasn't confirmed until early morning that there were no survivors in the plane crash. So yeah, it was a very sad time in our sport. And Alan's death was one of the first of several that would come in NASCAR over the next several years. You know, Davey Allison, we lost him shortly thereafter, a year or so down the road. So yeah, it was it began some difficult and trying times for the sport.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it was a tough season. So now, Chris, you've got some comments about DWR.
Yeah, so there's a motorsports podcast called Dinner with Racers. I know it may not be in our interest to promote another podcast. However, this podcast has an amazing series of interviews that they've done with a lot of people that were close to Alan, including Paul Andrews, his former crew chief, Peter Jellin, who actually drove the truck at Bristol that day and drove the two laps around the track and then drove off to the shop. His first car builder, a bunch of different, his priest, because Kowicki was extremely, was very religious, his best friend, his PR man. There were a lot of interviews that they conducted that really told the story of Alan Kowicki, not just the race car driver, but Alan Kowicki, the guy. And it's at dinnerwithracers.com, and each interview is, between an hour and 15 minutes to an hour and 45 minutes or so. So if you're driving a long distance, it's worth listening to. And they did a little 30-minute documentary where they took some excerpts and made a little video out of it. Very well done. I highly recommend it to anyone who wants to look at some quality content regarding Alan Kowicki.
Good stuff, Chris. Thanks for sharing that. And, oddly enough, so Kowicki's first win was at Phoenix. The IndyCar Series is going to race at Phoenix this week. And Phoenix is also celebrating an event that happened 25 years ago. And that is the last win for this kid from Pennsylvania named Mario Andretti. You guys heard of him?
That is from Italy.
No, well, modern-day Turkey, yeah, but now he grew up in Pennsylvania. He's from Italy, yeah. His last IndyCar win at 53 years 53 years old, was in Phoenix in 93. He had this hotshot teammate that came on board when the teammate was his own kid. His own kid went over to race in Formula One in 93. So they got Nigel Mansell. And I know, Richard, you probably remember him because you're British.
Once or twice.
So Mansell actually had a crash prior to Phoenix.
He did, yeah. He broke his back, didn't he?
Broke his back, was unable to race, and
put a hole in the wall.
Hole in the wall, big hole. Mario's last IndyCar win, and it was a pretty good win. Held off Paul Tracy, but they're going to celebrate that this coming weekend when the IndyCars return to Phoenix. So, guys, Mario Andretti, you heard of him? Any good stuff to
it's
say
easy
about
to hold
him?
Off Paul Tracy when Paul Tracy crashes. I actually watched that race recently with a few friends of mine on the internet, and Tracy was so dominant that day. He actually had the entire field. It was a 200 lap race. He had the entire field lapped by lap 42. He actually had the field lapped twice until, you know, by the time he had his incident late in the race. He was getting ready to put another lap on Jimmy Vassar going into turn one, and he backed out, and the way that he had backed out heading into the corner, it upset the car, spun, hit the wall in the first turn, and some of the debris damaged Emerson Fittipaldi's car, his teammate. On the very next restart, Fittipaldi goes into turn three, loses the back end of his car, and he crashes, and that gave Mario the lead late in the going, and Mario would not be headed off that day. Now, for that particular race, Paul Tracy had so much of a lead over a lot of other cars that he ended up finishing 16th with 161 laps completed. So he still did decently. He almost finished in the points, but he did get 1 point for, I think it was, leading the most laps.
Well, golly, thanks for like ruining it.
No, just what I did.
I watched it and I remember it well, and I do know that win kind of fell into Mario's lap, but deservedly so. You know, Mario has raced hard for a lot of wins, and he's won a lot of races. But you know, you and I both know that you know, you win some, you lose some, and sometimes the prize falls into your lap. It had been a couple of years since Mario had won. 1 year later, he would announce his Arrivederci Mario farewell tour. But this is the only guy to win races in 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, right?
I believe you're correct. 60s
through the 90s. He was a rookie at Indianapolis in 1965. So the four decades, but still, that's an amazing accomplishment. His last win before that race, I believe, was 1988 at Cleveland, if I remember right. He also won at Phoenix in 88, I believe, as well.
Yes, 88, yep. And one of the things going on at Phoenix, they're going to celebrate Mario. They're going to have his four race-winning cars on display from 1966, 67, 88, and then the 93 Newman Haas Lola in that lovely Kmart Texaco livery will be there on display. And on the track, they're going to go ahead and run it for a couple laps. So, you know, with that being said, so IndyCar is going to be in Phoenix this weekend.
And Marco is going to be running in a vintage livery as well. He's going to run in the same kind of a scheme that Mario had for his last win.
Yes, he's got a vintage helmet as well that matches Mario's helmet. So a lot of good stuff coming to Phoenix this weekend. But before we get into a Phoenix preview, there actually was a race this past weekend, not a major race, but a Formula 3 race, and it's only big in the news because Billy Munger, who the young British guy who's lost both his legs in a Formula 4 accident last year, this is his first race back in, made the podium. Richard, you got a chance to see it. You know, it's big in your country. Let's talk about Billy Munger driving that car with the hand controls and the implications of this and beyond.
Yeah, I mean, British Formula 3 is sort of the breeding ground for these guys coming through. I mean, if you look at a list of who's won the championships out there, it's you know, pretty much all of them at some point have either driven Formula One, IndyCar, Le Mans, DTM, something like that. You know, these are top guys that come through this series. So for Billy Monger to go out there and get a podium on his first race back, you know, bar nothing else, is impressive. You know, you have to have serious talent to get a podium in one of these cars, you know, period. The fact that he's done this, for the first time he's driven in a race in 9 months, and the fact that the poor kid here has lost both of his legs and come back and done that is astronomical. I mean, you really, you know, talk about comeback, fantastic, really is, and shows, you know, the determination of this kid ahead of anything else.
But not to mention the fact that he's driving with a whole different style, because he's using his hands with the hand controls to do stuff he's used to be doing with his feet. And he's kind of mastered this quite quickly. I know he's probably had a lot of simulator work with this one.
Sure.
But this is the first time in a competitive nature with the car, and he's on the podium.
I think what you tend to find is that these guys who are undoubtedly naturally talented, if they put their mind to it long enough, they can adapt to a situation like that. And you know, again, this is by no means trying to diminish his achievements here, but I think that if you give them a challenge to overcome something like that, you know, pretty quickly they can adapt, and they can train their muscle memory to, you know, change how the brain and their output tools, basically their hands, control the car rather than their legs. So my understanding is that the throttle is on a hand control, but the brake is still a mechanical brake pedal that he actuates with, this just sounds terrible, sorry, what remains of his lower leg. It's a bit like, in a way, sometimes when you see, like, I don't know, a golfer turn around and, you know, he's normally right-handed and he hits a shot left-handed. You know, these guys are good enough and talented enough that they could probably learn how to sort of swap, you know, right-hand, left-hand, and eventually, you know, be pretty competitive, because they just have that natural ability and that natural talent to, you know, convert their input into their brain into an output through a hand or a foot or whatever it may be to be competitive. It's pretty remarkable, and it's a testament to how these guys work and how their brains work to achieve what they do.
Okay, now I want to bring up a conversation that we had off the air earlier, okay? And there's a rule somewhere, and I really have been trying to find the verbiage of the rule, and I can't quite come up with it, that a driver has to be able to exit the cockpit under his own power within a certain amount of time, which I believe is 10 seconds, just as a safety means. And I don't know if this applies to Billy's situation or not, or if he was able to, if he was, and we had talked about this earlier, so let's get that conversation going again. You know, this has been dramatized in a movie or two, but, you know, movies are not real life, but obviously Billy was able
to. It's totally real life.
Okay. But Billy was obviously able to start this race. He, you know, had the blessing of the FIA or whoever, so whatnot. So, but is this, I mean, what does this mean for, you know, drivers going forward in the sport with disabilities and, you know, major disabilities in Billy's case here? And we've seen guys like Zanardi, who races in the BMW series with the hand controls as well, I don't know exactly what the rule is, but obviously these guys are in a car, they're doing well. What does this mean for the future of the sport, Richard?
Yeah, I'm not exactly 100% certain on the exact wording of the rules, but you're right. There is a sort of test, for want of a better word, that drivers have to pass before they are given a medical approval to race. I believe when Michael Schumacher broke his leg back in 99, I think he could have potentially returned to a race, one or two races earlier, but he couldn't extract himself from the car unaided, as the rule states. Now, that is the FIA rule. The British Formula 3 Championship, I think it is affiliated to the FIA. I don't think it falls under the FIA sanctioning body. I know the points from those races and championships can be approved for super license purposes, but I don't think it controls it. So it's the British Racing Drivers Club which oversees the British Formula 3 Championship. Now, a lot of the, especially the safety rules that series like the British Formula 3 impose are carried over from the FIA. So it'd be interesting to know exactly what that ruling is and that terminology is. But, you know, sometimes it is more than, you know, people have the opinion, well, you know, it's up to the driver. You know, if a driver can't get himself out of the car, then that's his problem, you know, which is a little bit of a sort of ignorant viewpoint, and I haven't said, you know, you do in these events have marshals and volunteers, and these guys do put themselves at risk and at danger. You've seen in Formula One in the last 20 years, there's been at least two marshals killed, if not more. So, you know, these guys, you know, the volunteers that go out every week to help these kids in these races, you know, you've got a responsibility to those guys as well. So, you know, if these guys can overcome these disabilities and, you know, extract themselves safely from a car and get into a safe position, then I don't see there's an issue there. You know, with society as a whole, you see the increased exposure to stuff like the Paralympics and the Winter Paralympics we've had recently. It's great for these people some of them have gone through unimaginable difficulties. And, you know, to get to where they are is a huge testament to their character, far more so than able-bodied athletes in many, many ways. So they need to be encouraged, and motorsport cannot be seen to sort of discriminate against them or push them back. And if these guys can, you know, at the end of the day, they've still got to look after themselves, but you've got to try and remove these barriers. If they can look after themselves, they're not a danger to their other competitors. They're not a danger to, we may have to put themselves in a dangerous position to help get them out of a car, then I think they need to be encouraged as much as anybody. And I think, you know, this Billy's setting a fantastic example for people who have gone through these terrible ordeals.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and now Seth, you've got a couple of parallel stories from NASCAR we talked about earlier. You know, with Dale Jr. with a concussion and a few other stories. So, if you would chime in on this conversation, that'd be great.
Well, I vaguely remember in 2003 after Dale Jr.'s first concussion, which came at Fontana, they had mentioned on the broadcast the next week that before Jr. could run practice laps, he had to show that he could get out of the car on his own. They didn't really go into that much detail or if there was a specific amount of time that they had to do it. But NASCAR has similar rules. I do remember also in NASCAR, Ernie Irvin, after his second near-fatal accident before his comeback, he tested a car at Daytona months before he was approved. And the reason why he wasn't approved is because doctors weren't sure, A, that he could take the G-forces, or B, after running several laps, would be coherent enough to get out of the car. And the way they did that, after Dale Jarrett tested the car, he went to the hauler with his helmet on and fire suit. About 5 minutes later, Ernie Irvin walked out with his helmet and fire suit on, and nobody could tell the difference because they were both wearing full face helmets. So,
you couldn't make it up, could you?
I was going to say, that's a great story. I'd never heard that one before.
It was Daytona testing. I want to say it was 1996 or 97. I'm not entirely sure the year. But, again, it was just in testing. And it was about 5 or 6 months later that Ernie made his official return in a truck race at, I want to say it was either Martinsville or North Wilkesboro. And there are a handful of other stories of drivers with disabilities. Michael Johnson, as we were talking before the show, who ran in USF 2000 and Pro Mazda. And someone I followed, Ashley Fielek, who is deaf in X Games and motocross, from 2008 to 2012, the 5 years she was competitive, she won 4 championships and 2 gold medals in X Games. What sidelined her was 3 concussions in the course of a year and a half. But there are drivers who do have some disabilities here and there. The stories are few and far between, unfortunately. But I tweeted out after Billy Monger's podium finish that if he isn't an inspiration or an inspirational athlete, I don't know who is.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a great inspiration. And I remember, you know, I guess it was 2 years ago, watching Zanardi in the Paralympics with his taking his 2nd gold in the wheelchair racing thing there, and just the tremendous upper body strength he's gained from not having lower extremities, and I kind of paralyzed when I saw Billy Monger getting himself in the car, and Billy's only been legless for less than a year, where he was able to kind of put himself in that car. I feel like he could probably pull himself out of that car, but Chris, your point, or Chris, you and I follow IndyCar racing rather closely, and the safety team in IndyCar, they are so quick on the scene. They are so quick there when something happens. I mean, is this, you have to get out of the car under your own power, is this necessary this day and age when the safety teams are so quick to run, they're right there?
Honestly, not really as much, because I mean, at Indianapolis, the safety team is often rolling before the car has even come to a full stop. Jack Harvey discovered that perilously in this past year's Indy 500 when he actually almost hit a safety truck while he was spinning. Another thing is that there have also been drivers with disabilities in IndyCar racing as well. One particular driver of note is a guy named Cal Nidey, who drove in the 1950s at Indianapolis and actually hit the wall during the 1955 race. Funny enough, in one of the blind spots in the track where the radio couldn't get to, he lived in Hawaii in the later part of his life. But, yeah, he was one of the few one-legged drivers that actually drove in Indianapolis.
Yeah, and if you think about it, right, if that driver, whether they're able-bodied or disabled, right, if they're in a wreck, they may not be able to get out of the car on their own power anyway, right? I mean, was Hinchcliffe able to get out of the car on his own power when he had his years ago? Was Bourdais able to get out of the car under his own power? No, but the safety team was right there to tend to him. So why would it be different for somebody who has some disabilities going into thing? I don't know. It's just food for thought.
Absolutely.
Let's preview this week of racing. Formula One is in Bahrain. IndyCar is in Phoenix. NASCAR is in Texas. Let's start with Formula One, Richard, and give you some props. Let's talk about Bahrain. We saw the opening race of the season was won by Ferrari. Mercedes wasn't very far off. Mercedes probably should have won. What should we look for in Bahrain?
Yeah, I think without even the greatest Ferrari fanatic must admit that Mercedes probably did have the beating of them there in Melbourne. And I think in all fairness, you're going to see a lot of the same again this coming weekend. You're still in the flyaway stage of the season, so you're not going to see huge upgrades for any of the cars, maybe the odd tweak here or there, but you're not going to see any big leaps by any of the manufacturers until you get to Barcelona at the start of the European season. So I think you'll see a lot of, you know, as we've already seen so far. I fear that you're going to get another processional race, for want of a better word, similar to Melbourne. Bahrain's not the greatest overtaking circuit in the world. Turn one, turn two, then that run out to turn three can get a little bit feisty. But again, you're not going to see a huge amount, I don't think. So it's going to be very similar to Melbourne in many ways. But I think it's going to be pretty much the same as we saw 2 weeks ago in Melbourne. I think Mercedes is going to be the class of the field, and it's their race to lose rather than anybody else to win.
And so how do you feel like our American friends, the Haas team, are going to do, provided they can, you know, put the wheels on the car properly on a pit stop? Cool. Because they were darn strong. They were, you know, only behind Ferrari and Mercedes, and they were ahead of the Red Bulls. I mean, can we see a podium for the Haas team, provided we have the pit stop problems out? Or
I think they were probably ahead of Red Bull more on. I don't think they were ahead of Red Bull on raw pace. I think if Daniel Ricciardo hadn't had his issue during qualifying or practice and had that penalty, and Max Verstappen hadn't had the damage to his car, which supposedly resulted in him spinning out and losing a few spaces there, I would expect those Haas cars will be, what does that leave them, 7th, 8th. You know, the best of the rest still. McLaren may push them, Renault may push them, but as I say, you're not going to see huge upgrades to any of these cars yet at this stage of the season, so I don't think you're going to see any great leaps in the pecking order. So they'll be there or thereabouts. I think I'll say, yeah, I expect both of those cars to make it into Q3, and they'll be strong again. I think some of the words coming out, some of the noises coming out of that team, you know, how Gene Haas has been pushing them and how he's been sort of leading the team there, I think is good. I think he's going about it the right way. You know, everybody's seen those iconic pictures of Grosjean going around his mechanics post-race and the guys that were responsible for the pit stop failures. You know, you win as a team and you lose as a team. So you've got to take that into consideration. I doubt you'll see the Haas team at the top of the pit stop charts come Sunday evening. I think they'll be pretty slow and deliberate about it, but they've got the pace, I think, to match where they were in Melbourne. I wouldn't expect to see too many changes.
All right, so you're predicting a Mercedes-Ferrari podium?
I would have thought so, yes. I can't see any reason why it wouldn't.
Christopher, do you have any opposing viewpoint to that?
I think it would take a decent amount of change to get Haas up there. I mean, let's face it, when you have a double retirement because of a crew malfunction like that, it can be really, really damaging to your spirit, unless, of course, you can just mentally kind of push it in the rearview mirror. Although I will say this, I think that if they do manage to get a great result in Bahrain, let's say that the entire F1 world goes crazy and they get a podium, I think you'll see a nice party out of Bahrain for those guys, and you might hear some great music. Do the hustle.
Do the hustle. Yeah, I just feel like these flyaway races, before we get back to the center of a format, are their best chance to do something. But
without doubt.
We'll see how it goes.
But you look at Bahrain again, and it'd be interesting to see how it gets handled, especially by the new owners, because going off on a tangent here a little bit. You know, this is one of these sort of Bernie races, isn't it, that was sort of gone out to these oil-rich countries out in the, in the Gulf states. And you really have to ask the question, what does it bring to Formula One, especially with Bahrain having a, how should we put this tactfully, a questionable human rights history? Is that somewhere that Formula One really needs to be associated with?
Well, to be fair, Formula One was in South Africa during the 70s and 80s and 90s.
Sure. But this is under a new ownership now. You know, do Liberty, are they going to make a stand to this? Are they going to... They want to be this sort of family-friendly media brand that, you know, everybody loves. Do you want to, you know, how seriously do you think they'll take this?
Are we looking at getting out of China as well?
Well, who knows? I mean, I think you have to be in China because of the, you know, from a, it's one of the largest countries in the world. And yes, you obviously, again, yeah, you know, but the only reason you're in Bahrain is because of the money. Yeah, they're not one of the biggest car manufacturers in the world. Obviously, they have a lot of money from the oil producing aspect of it. But, yeah, you know, would you rather see a race at, goodness me, this isn't exactly a country with a great record at the moment, Turkey, around Istanbul Park, which is undoubtedly a far better track than Bahrain? Or, I mean, we're going back to Manicor, but, you know, securing, you know, the French Grand Prix, securing the German Grand Prix, going to proper heartland races that will sell out. I mean, you know, you could hold a race in Hockenheim and you get 200,000 people there in a heartbeat. You don't get that in Bahrain or China or places like that.
Having a full spectator crowd, you know, does help. Although, from what I've heard, you know, by moving the race to a night race in Bahrain, it has helped ticket sales, which is good. I mean, I think Formula One did a right move in Bahrain by making it a night race. I think frankly a lot better. So that might be a reason why it stays on the calendar, honestly.
Yeah. I mean, they've obviously invested a lot of money to put those, you know, lighting up and everything, so they're going to want a return on that investment. But
That company that did it is Musco Lighting, which also did the lighting over at Charlotte Motor Speedway.
Okay, yeah.
So there is a Charlotte connection all the way around the world. I know, yeah. To the back, Musco is actually based out of Iowa.
Oh, but okay, I'm with you.
Right, but the Musco takes care of most of the NASCAR tracks. So, all right, one quick round of table. Everybody gets a pick for Bahrain, and then we're going to preview NASCAR at Texas. Gray, I'm going to give you the first pick for the Formula One race.
I'm going to say Hamilton.
All right, Seth?
Vettel.
Chris?
Well, since he said Vettel, I'll say Raikkonen.
And Richard?
Bottas.
And who'd you leave me to pick? Alonso. I pick Alonso for fifth place.
Oh, wait,
yeah,
hang on.
So.
Yeah.
All right,
if it rains, that could be a good shout.
Yeah. All right, guys. So Formula One is in Bahrain, going to be on what, ESPN2 in the middle of the night on Saturday, or
I think about early Sunday morning, wouldn't it? Be about
early Sunday morning,
7 or 8 o'clock Sunday morning.
All right, we'll see. So NASCAR is going to be at Texas. Gray, what are we going to look for in Texas when NASCAR comes to this 1.5-mile oval? Who do you like?
We're going to look to see who is going to come to the forefront and dominate the race. Will it be the 78, or will it be a car from Stuart Haas? If we're following trends that have been showing up so far this year, we don't know which. I would say one of those two teams will prevail, and throw in the 18 in there too, because he's been right there knocking on the door. But I think I think these races will be no different from the other mile and a half we've already run this year, and we're going to see it come down between probably Harvick and Truex and Kyle Busch to decide the winner.
All right, and Seth, your comments are?
Well, don't forget about the Chevrolets. And the reason why I'm saying that, although they haven't really been there the first six races of the year, I don't know what the situation is at Richard Childress Racing, but I do know for some of the Chevy teams, they have only had a handful of cards to work with. Tad Geschefter, for example, of JTG Doherty Racing, he said that there wasn't enough sheet metal provided by Chevrolet at first to go around to all the teams before the West Coast swing. So they have been behind the eight ball a little bit with not having enough cards to really adjust to essentially work with at the track. So I expect Chevrolets to basically come around and run better starting at Texas, maybe even next week at Bristol.
So is there a particular Chevrolet car that you think is going to come to the forefront? Maybe old Kyle Larson?
Well, Kyle Larson has really been the standard bearer for Chevrolet so far. I mean, you can throw out the Daytona 500 because that's a race all into itself. But, you know, once we leave Daytona and get into the downforce tracks is where the Ford dominance and, of course, Truex dominance in California has come to the front. I think Chevrolet is a little bit behind the eight ball. They're going to work, and obviously I think they will get better as the year goes on. I think right now, really, we've seen some glimpses from the 9 car. He's run well at times, and obviously the 42. But they really – and Jimmy Johnson, he hasn't shown much speed in that 48 so far this year. I think he's got, maybe one top 10 so far. I do think they'll get better as we go along. It's just gonna take a little bit of time to develop this new car, and Seth could be right. They could show a little bit more this weekend at Texas. But I tell you what, it's gonna be hard to go against what we've seen from the 4 team and the 78 and the 18 so far in the season. Those guys are on a roll.
And just another thought on that, like you said, we haven't really seen much from Jimmy Johnson or Hendrick in general. Going into Texas, Hendrick Motorsports has the same number of top 10s as Paul Menard.
Okay, so that's a bad thing.
Hands
right?
up on who predicted that.
Well, and look at this too. I tell you, you got to look at where Hendrick Motorsports is at right now. They've got a very young team. Obviously, you've got Seasoning and Johnson and Chase Elliott. Eric Bowman, the Bowman kid, Alex Bowman, I'm sorry. It's going to take a little while for that team to gel and come together. And I tell you, the William Byron thing, that's going to be a project all year long. He has not fared very well, and quite frankly, I'm not surprised that he's not had run too well in Cup. I mean, that's a different thing. I thought all along that they probably rushed him to Cup maybe a year too early. He could have benefited from another year Seasoning in the Xfinity Series, but they'll take their lumps as they go throughout the course of the year. He'll be better for it in the long run, but it's going to be a tough road for those guys in the 24 this year.
Absolutely, yeah. I agree with you that William Byron could have used one more year before he's up to cut. But, man, kid was hot, and the price was right for the team. So go around the table. Picks for Texas. I'm going to start with you, Richard.
Chase Elliott.
And Chris?
Keselowski.
All right, Seth?
Truex.
And Gray?
Harvick.
And I'm going to go with, I don't know, man, Kurt Busch. I'm going to go with the other Tony Stewart car. So now, we've got a few minutes left to talk about IndyCar coming to Phoenix. Now, IndyCar came back to Phoenix in 2016 after an 11-year layoff. The last two races have not produced great racing. Chris, you'll agree with me on that. The racing was okay, but it was not great. There was it's hard to pass, but if the test data from the late winter test is anything to kind of like hold on to something to, we may be able to see some actual passing, some actual cars be able to run behind one another without the wake of all that aerodynamic stuff coming off. So what are your thoughts on what we're going to see in Phoenix? Can we build this race up? Can we save it? Can we keep it on the schedule? Can we build the crowd? Chris, what are your thoughts?
I think we can keep it on the schedule, but it's going to be difficult because when they made the modifications to it, they made it much more of a NASCAR track instead of the traditional open wheel background that it had when they made all the changes to it. I think having less downforce will ultimately help.
Chris, the changes to the track are going to be largely in November. This is going to be the last race on the current Phoenix layout.
I think if I remember right, all they're doing is just changing the location of the start-finish line, right?
The front stretch is now going to be the back stretch. The finish line is going to be between turn one and the dog leg. So the configuration of the track doesn't change. So I'm not sure what you're going after where they've made it.
Well, when they changed it a couple of years ago.
You mean the 2010 progressive banking?
That whole deal.
Yeah. Okay.
And they changed the dog leg on the back. That's
right,
what
I was
referencing.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
That's what I was referencing. It made it more unfriendly to open wheel. I'm hoping that they can make it more open wheel friendly. But it's kind of a rough ask considering that it is an ISC track. But I hope that we get a lot better racing because the fans deserve it after not having had that track there that track on schedule for that long.
Not to mention IndyCar needs that region of the country. They need the Southwest.
Yes, absolutely. Frank?
And I think too, maybe, when they did make the changes to Phoenix, they had to kind of, they tried to compromise and make it because the NASCAR races were somewhat lackluster, and they tried to improve that and probably were, I agree, maybe a little bit to the detriment of the Indy cars. But we won't know what this new package will do when they go out there, so we'll have to kind of wait and see. What were your impressions when they tested out there?
Decently impressed, although there is still a little bit of a difficulty in getting the cars to actually pass each other. I'm wondering, just for the heck of it, if there's one that I think that they didn't get right is maybe they should have put more emphasis on underbody downforce than top body. One thing that made the kart car so much easier to get around was that they developed a ton of their downforce from the underfloor of the car, which I think that if they went back to having more and more downforce from the underside of the car, it would help to be less reliant on the top side, which would make it easier to pass.
Yeah, so you think they'll develop this car more as the year goes forward? They will help the sanctioning body will help these cars.
Maybe not this year, but I would say next year. Possibly next year would be the year that they would do a major change like that.
Yeah, I mean, this year we'll see how it performs at every track, on a short oval, on a long oval, on a super speedway, on a road course. We'll see how it works, but they've taken a ton of downforce off of the top of the car and put a lot of it back under the car, not to the degree we had in the cart era, but I honestly think we'll see a better race than last year unless it turns out to be a shit show where people are crashing left and right, and that could seriously be the case, but we won't know till we get them all on the track and see. So
How many, what are we looking at for a field out there? 24 cars?
23. There's 23 okay. cars right. starting the race, yep. So, I'm sorry, I was reading Seth's comments about the radius of the turn. So, but I think this is probably, of the three Phoenix races since we've returned, this is probably going to be the best. The first two were not great. Just because the package didn't agree with it, so we'll have to see. And but that's a like, you know, to your point, Gray, that's a market IndyCar needs, and mm-hmm. let's just hope that they. And that's a track that has a long open wheel history. That track was purpose built for open wheel racing in 1964. The first winner was AJ Foyt. So,
you know, one other thing too that will bode well for both IndyCar and NASCAR. Some of the things that they're going to go forward with, some of the amenities that they're going to bring to the track in the future will be good for all race fans. So hopefully, you know, if IndyCar can have a really good show this time and build some momentum when they go back again, you know, with a good race under their belt along with these amenities, these new amenities that they're adding to the track, maybe you know, they can grab a more firmer toehold out there.
Oh, absolutely! Yeah, I mean the plans for the new track are fantastic. I, you know, when NASCAR Cup rolls back around for the chase race later in the season, everything will be in place, and it just the everything I've seen, all the plans, it looks absolutely beautiful. Yeah, we're reconfigured. They're not really reconfiguring track. They're just changing, you know, the old front stretch.
Superfluous things.
Yes, yeah, but yeah, but, well, you know, Gray, you and I saw that in Darlington years ago, back in the '90s. They moved they switched the back stretch and the front stretch, and
yep.
put new grandstands there.
Yeah.
And
well, Phoenix has come a long way from my first trip to Phoenix. I remember when we would arrived at the racetrack, and we had to be really careful walking around through the garage area, setting up the cars and moving trash cans. You had to look under trash cans and other things for rattlesnakes, you know, when we were out there early on. So that has changed a little bit. But one other thing I wanted to bring to was, as it pertains to IndyCar, I saw this week where they talked about Laguna Seca. The new owners out there, the new people that are going to take over the track are going to change the direction of the track. And I didn't know whether, you know, if that might be on IndyCar's radar to return there.
Nothing on IndyCar's radar right now, but we'll have to see how the new owners do with it.
I thought that was an April Fool's joke, though.
Yeah, yeah, it was April Fool's
joke. Yeah, that was.
Was it April Fool's joke? Okay. I mean, I fell for it, hook, line, and sinker, because the track map and everything there, so yeah.
But the funniest April Fool's joke this year was Harding Racing announced that Alonso Jr. would be competing in the Indy 500 this year, and I think for me what put the icing on the cake was that Alonso Jr. did not know that they were, that the team put that release out, actually. Although, this is just my own personal opinion. The best ever motorsports April Fool's Day prank was what iRacing did in 2016 when they announced Dirt was coming to the service. And the reason why that was so great to me is because that they were actually serious about it, and no one believed them until a couple months later when they showed a video of what they were doing with Dirt, and everyone was like, whoa, they're actually serious.
So it really wasn't an April Fool's joke, was it? So,
well, it was great that they announced it on that day because, you know, how many people are going to take you seriously? They had done a different April Fool's Day jokes before to, you know, varying degrees of success.
No, they had several out there this year. I mean, of course, I fell for the one on Laguna Seca, and then, of course, there was the electric car thing with NASCAR.
NASCAR going electric.
Frank had his.
Yep, and WEC is going to mandate the halo for the sports cars. And
that was funny.
And there was one on a British website that's going to Alonso and not Alonso, but rather Hamilton and Vettel were going to switch teams. Yeah, a lot of good fun April Fool stuff. But, guys, we are just about out of time. So, excuse me. We have enough time for everybody to make a pick for the IndyCar winner in Phoenix. And I'm going to start with you, Richard.
Bourdais.
Okay, Seth, you're next.
I'll say Andretti.
Okay. Yeah. I would love to see Marco Andretti winning that throwback livery back to his granddad's car.
And exactly Gray, why I'm picking it.
Yes. Gray, who do you like for Phoenix IndyCar?
The defending champion, Newgarden.
All right. Christopher?
I'll say Ed Jones. And if Sebastian wins, he'll be Sebastian Bourdais.
Okay. Oh. That's like a real
Sebastian
bad pun.
Yeah.
I'm going to say Scott Dixon wins this thing. And with that being said, I want to say goodnight to you, Gray, Seth, Richard, Chris. I want to say goodnight to you viewers, listeners, rather, for tuning in. Thank you to Hoobazoo Radio Network. Thank you to iHeartRadio. Thank you to Spreaker for carrying us. Guys, have a great racing week. We'll talk to you in 7 days. Good night.
Enter website.